Good morning. This is the beginning of the broadcast day. The beginning of the live broadcast day for Saturday, March 7th in the year 2015 for Free Radio Santa Cruz. It is 11:02 a.m. and this is the Mideast Migraines program.
Oh, يا من سواك بالهوى ما لي سبيل مر على عين يرضي الطياب سبيل عمدناك إسابي أنت وأنا يفنى الهوى من بعيدنا غرامك مهجتي وعطفك سبيلي وعلى ربعك أنا جعل سبيلي لأجلك هجرت أهلي والصحاب يا عين يا عين يا عين يا عين يا عين
You young folks out there, does the name Danny Thomas strike a nerve at all, or at least remind you of anyone? Danny Thomas. He passed away around 1991 and took a swing at a few movie roles in his early days, and then he became a comedian. I think he may have done some stand-up in his early days and did a TV show, comedy sitcom, Make Room for Daddy, back in the 60s. And that was his voice you heard singing. This, of course, is my taken from my beloved The Music of Arab Americans, a retrospective collection, Rounder Records. The album is 1997. From a track entitled Arabic Folk Songs, sponsored by St. Jude Hospital Foundation, Danny Thomas may be more mostly recommended for his association with that organization. Although Danny Thomas performed widely for the Arab American community, this record, made in 1952, is his only recording of Arab music, only known recording at any rate. The proceeds from the record, as well as from the numerous haflas, or parties, music parties, presented by Thomas, benefited St. Jude Hospital Foundation, which has become one of the most important institutions in the world for the research and treatment of children's diseases. Known by mainstream America only as a comedian and actor, Thomas continued to sing Arabic songs in cameo and guest performances until just a few months before his death in 1991. Here, you heard Thomas singing a medley. Singing a medley of Lebanese folk songs, beginning with the ever-popular Lebanese genres of Mijani and Ataba. Thomas is supported by the capable oud playing of Tufik Barham, an active performer throughout this century whose lovely Takasim and Makam Bayati finishes off the performance. Based in a tradition of improvised sung poetry that dates back perhaps hundreds of years, the genres Mijana and Ataba have enjoyed tremendous staying power and are still popular among contemporary Lebanese audiences throughout the diaspora, and of course that refers to the Arabic diaspora throughout the world. And I remember there is this recording, and the only other hint that I ever had, being Thomas being one of my favorite funny men from my childhood, was an episode of Make Room for Daddy where he visits with his family, his in-laws, his wife's parents in Ireland, and they welcome him with open arms until Thomas sits at a piano, and on this particular episode, sits at the piano and begins playing Arabic-tinged music and begins singing basically in the same style that you just heard, and his father-in-law and mother-in-law are staring at him with, they're not smiling, but they're staring and have quizzical looks, almost offended looks on their faces while he is trying to entertain them. And boy, you know, these are Irish people back in the old country of Ireland, and they started treating him like a stranger after that for at least part of the rest of the episode. I guess they thought that was funny back in those days. But yes, that was the voice of Danny Thomas you heard singing some Arabic folk songs. And to me, he, even though they are quote-unquote only folk songs, they are most definitely, I mean, to me, he sounds like a classically trained Arabic song voice, Arabic voice. Sounds like he knows what he's doing and well-practiced. Very impressive. Hi, my name is Ren Tawil, and you are listening to the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're streaming live at freakradio.org. That's freakradio.org. We broadcast at 101.3 on the FM dial. And if you are listening to us on the radio right now and you would ever prefer to hear our free streaming service, go to freakradio.org, click on listen, and follow the instructions on how to pick up our signal online. You may also click on the red oval on top of the little cartoon picture of the radio tower there. Saturday editions of Mideast Migraines are dedicated to the readings of important current or almost current books regarding Palestinians and Israelis. I did read a short anthology written by 8 Jewish authors on the topic of anti-Semitism. The book was entitled Reframing Anti-Semitism. But with the exception of that short paperback anthology, I've been reading full-length, single-authored, generally, well, not necessarily single-authored, yeah, single-authored books. And I'm currently doing Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine, a Jewish-American woman in the occupied territories. Before that, however, let me do this one public service announcement. I had to look long and hard to figure out exactly where this takes place. It takes place in Seaside, toward the southern end of Monterey Bay here, just north of the city of Monterey. Free community event on March 21st. That's a Saturday. From Vivian Larkins. Hello, I am writing to request... Well, okay. Health Project Center is presenting Caregiver University on March 21st, Saturday, March 21st. A free day of classes for those who care for loved ones. Caring for an ill or incapacitated loved one can be isolating and very challenging. This event is designed to support and educate local caregivers. We hope you will be able to help publicize this important community event. If you have any questions, please feel free to contact me. Me is Vivian Larkins. At the following phone number, area code 831-459-6639. Or Vivian, V-I-V-I-A-N, Vivian at hpcn.org. Vivian at hpcn.org. Vivian Larkins, Health Project Center. Here is the actual press release here. Caregiver University, a day of learning and sharing. Are you a caregiver for a loved one? You are not alone. You can find helpful information and resources at Caregiver University. Join us for a free day of learning and sharing presented by local experts. Topics include understanding the aging process, stress reduction techniques, and legal issues for caregivers. Free lunch is included. How about that, folks? This is a free event with a free lunch provided. Spanish translation will be available. Register early for this free Saturday event that will be held March 21st from 9 in the morning, 9 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. in Seaside, just ways down the coast here from Santa Cruz. You can call it, as I said, 831-459-6639 to register. 831-459-6639 or visit DelmarCaregiver.org. DelmarCaregiver.org. Health Project Center is a private nonprofit 501c3 community-based health organization that has been serving California's Central Coast since 1980. I would love to go to that, but of course I'm busy here doing my program, and I'm in the middle of a book, as I always am on Saturdays. Anyway, I don't want to interrupt that. You might want to consider this free day of learning and sharing for caring for elderly or infirmed loved ones. Okay. A couple of reminders. The recordings of my programs, both the Saturday edition and the Monday 3 p.m. edition, are available at my archives, which are posted at two other websites, radioforall.net. That's radio, the number four, ALL.net, radioforall.net. Radioforall.net you will go to and load up Mideast Migraines for my most recent, the most recent recordings of my programs. You may also go to Santa Cruz Media Center, Indy Bay, I-N-D-Y-B-A-Y, and you will find, most easily find the most recent recordings of the Mideast Migraines program. It's best to go to radioforall.net. That's the most accessible location, and then you may listen to the shows at your own convenience. You're welcome to share them and make the best conceivable use of them. I will give out the phone numbers to the studio, live to the studio, in about an hour or so. Roughly at the mid-program break, we go until 1 o'clock this afternoon. Until then, no phone calls, please. I prefer the readings from the chapters of the book to be uninterrupted. Otherwise, if you want to communicate something to me, write to this Mideast Migraines Program's email address, MideastMadness@GMX.com. That's MideastMadness@GMX.com. And you are listening to the Mideast Migraine Show Saturday edition with your host, Ren. Gee, I only wish I can get this sucker to behave here. Has nothing to do with what I'm saying right now. But just trying to get my computer screen to calm down here. Okay, let's do it. Now, I'm not going to read the entire introduction or every last printed review of the book, and there are a lot that have been included in the printing. Again, the author is Anna Balzer, witness in Palestine, a Jewish-American woman in the occupied territories, copyright 2007, and this is the updated and revised edition of 2014. Let me read you the back cover anyway. In 2003, Anna Balzer, a young Jewish American, visited the West Bank, of Palestine, to discover for herself the realities of everyday life for Palestinians living under Israeli occupation. What she found would change her outlook on the issue forever. For 8 months over the following 4 years, that's 2003 to 2007, Balzer lived and worked with farmers, Palestinian and Israeli activists, and the families of political prisoners, traveling with them across checkpoints and roadblocks to reach hospitals, universities, and olive groves. Balzer witnessed firsthand the devastation wrought by expanding settlements and the wall, which separates Palestinians from each other, their land, and basic human services. She also encountered countless Palestinian grievances beyond the occupation of non-Jews living in a Jewish state and refugees yearning to return to their homes and land. Balzer's probing and honest examination of the occupation, of Zionism, and the pervasive spirit of Palestinian resilience offers a fresh look at Palestine today. This book, by the way, is available from Paradigm Publishers in Boulder, Colorado, www.paradigmpublishers.com. And a couple of real fast, three real short reviews here. Balzer's profound and penetrating insight offers an important and timely perspective on the role internationals have in Palestine's struggle. Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, Palestinian physician and presidential candidate. Dr. Mustafa Barghouti. Mazin Kumsiye, author of Sharing the Land of Canaan. Captivating text and artistic photography, a deeply personal story that will inspire you not only to have hope, but to actively seek and work for peace and justice. Finally, Ilan Pape, the Israeli historian, a must-read, deeply engaged, informative, and incisive. You cannot allow yourself to skip this compassionate analysis. The chapters are not numbered. Rather, this book is presented in dated journal entries. So here we go with Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine, a Jewish-American woman in the occupied territories. Updated to just last year, 2014. We are, a good 20 or so pages into the book at this point. On the way to the Samaria ruins. Sunday, November 30, 2003. Without experiencing it firsthand, it's hard to imagine what it's like to wait at a checkpoint. For most Americans, the only thing like it is security at airports, especially right after the September 11th attacks. Most of us have been through it. You arrive at the airport and wait in line to show your ID to get a boarding pass. Then you rush to another line where you wait to go through security. Airport employees open your bags, shuffle through your belongings, ask you to take off your belt and shoes. When that's over, you rush to the gate where, often, you are checked in. How do you feel going through this screening process? How do you feel going through the screening process? Are you annoyed that you have to wait? Are you thankful that someone is watching out for your safety? Have you ever missed a flight because of heightened security? I have, but I still comply at airports, as most of us do, because we figure it's a necessary precaution. And we know it's only once in a while. Now imagine that you went through the airport's three-stage 80-minute security process 2, 4, 6 times every day. She italicizes every day. Every time you went to work, to school, to the hospital, or to visit your family. Imagine that every little movement in your life involved the chaos and burden of going through airport security. Imagine that instead of flights, you stood to miss weddings, graduations, funerals, and other major life events. Think of how impatient many of us become waiting in line at the grocery store or the post office, and compare it to how much more Palestinians go through all day long trying to get anywhere. That gives you a small hint of how disruptive checkpoints are to Palestinian daily life. She includes three color pictures here of the process of waiting at a checkpoint, a lineup of cars. Step one, Palestinians wait in line to be checked. Now standing in line by the front door of a charter bus here, the entranceway of which is blocked by an Israeli soldier. Step two, Palestinians get out of their vehicles. Final picture, step three, Palestinians must show their IDs to soldiers. Okay, let's continue with the text. It's always tempting to want to read the captions of these pictures, and I don't want to torment anyone by reading them without letting you see them. But once again, if you go to paradigmpublishers.com, you can inquire about getting your own copy of Witness in Palestine. Continuing with the text of the book now. Checkpoints are not just frustrating, they are debilitating. It's hard to hold a steady job if you never know whether it will take you 15 minutes or 4 hours to get to work, unless you happen to have a university in your village or the funds for a second residence. Higher education is probably out of the question. And if you require urgent medical care, you're out of luck if there's a checkpoint between your home and the nearest hospital. During my stay in Nablus, my friend Aldo and I went to visit the ancient Israelite ruins of Samaria near the Palestinian village of Sabastia. We chose somewhere close, hoping we could relax. Our destination was just 9 miles away, but checkpoints along the way prolonged our journey to almost 2.5 hours. We arrived at Beit Eba, the first checkpoint, to find a group of more than 50 Palestinians waiting in the sun. They looked like they had been there for a long time, and it was another 15 minutes before the army began to show signs that they were going to start allowing people to come up and show IDs to try to get through. There was a long walkway of about 150 feet between the soldiers and the crowd of waiting Palestinians huddled around a concrete roadblock. A soldier pointed his gun from his post to the crowd and shouted at the whole group to take a step back. All the men picked up their bags, all the women picked up the children, and everyone took one step back, so they are now 152 feet away from the soldiers. The soldier walked from one side of the post to the other and then commanded the group to take another step back. The group grumbled but obliged. The soldier began to talk to another soldier who then yelled to the group to take another... The soldier began to talk to another soldier who then yelled to the group to take another step back. Finally, one soldier... It's, the repetitiveness of what's going on makes it difficult to actually read this. Finally, one soldier motioned for people to start advancing. Six women and children started towards the checkpoint window at the other end of the path. A soldier yelled something to them, and the group stopped and looked confused. Then they understood. The soldier only wanted two people at a time. So four stopped to wait, but another soldier yelled at them to get back to the concrete block. They turned around to walk back. When they arrived, it was their time to go up, so they turned around to walk up again, two by two. The process was painful to watch. Dignified but exhausted people trying not to lose their tempers or their pride as they obeyed seemingly arbitrary commands to move to and from the window and the concrete block in the hot sun, carrying bags and babies. The soldiers seemed nervous and adamant about maintaining their control of the situation. Aldo and I stayed behind with the crowd to avoid the possibility of making the soldiers more nervous until we felt we could do some good. We didn't have to wait long. The fourth group up was a mother, father, and young daughter holding her father's hand. When the mother handed over their ID cards, the soldier walked over to the father and yelled something very loudly and violently in his face. The little girl by his side burst into tears. Aldo and I quickly moved down the path to the confrontation, where we quietly watched it develop. The father was trying to comfort the daughter, and the mother was yelling at the soldier in Hebrew. A second soldier asked us what we were doing, and we said we were watching. He said that was illegal. I told him that was not true and that I was curious what the problem was with the family. He said that the family was Palestinian, but they had Israeli passports, so they should not have been allowed into Nablus in the first place. Israelis are prohibited from entering the city, incidentally, she says here. He said it didn't matter if they had relatives there. I pointed out that they were trying to leave Nablus, not enter it. But the soldier was unmoved. I told him I was concerned about the first soldier's behavior towards the family. The first soldier overheard my comments and looked noticeably embarrassed that his outburst had been witnessed by internationals. The soldier told us to go either through the checkpoint or back to the block. About halfway down the path, back toward the crowd, I turned and saw the soldiers let the family through. It was a quick, sweet moment of relief, but there were at least 40 people still waiting to get through. Then an amazing thing happened. The line started to move quickly. An old woman was woken up from her nap in the dirt to walk the path, and the old men were let through while the luck lasted. While the luck lasted, people were called up in fives and let through with almost no hassle. Aldo and I looked at one another in wonder. Could it be that easy to make a difference? Within 20 minutes, all 50 people were through, along with another 20 or so who had arrived during the hour of waiting. After the last man passed, Aldo and I approached the window. There was a female soldier checking IDs. She was pretty, with big eyes and spiky hair. She looked at my passport for a minute and then frowned up at me. She asked, "Your name is Anna?" "Yes," I answered, and started to get nervous. Then she passed me my passport back and smiled. "So is mine." It was a wonderful feeling to walk beyond the checkpoint. It was a relief to pass through, and although we could not be certain, it was encouraging to believe that our presence may have made a difference. The Palestinians were surer of the difference than we were. After crossing, we found several smiling and waiting to welcome us onto a bus. Kids ran up to hold our hands, and a teenage girl offered me her seat to the bus next to her mother, who invited us to her home. We didn't have the chance to accept, because before we knew it, we were waiting in line again at another checkpoint. Our bus waited 10 minutes until we reached the front of the line, where we were asked to get off the bus and show our IDs. Again, the soldiers separated the men and women and let the women back on the bus. Aldo and I stayed with the men. The soldiers then let all but two men go, but still we stayed. The soldiers asked us what we were doing, and we said we were wondering what the two men had done. They said they could not tell us, but that they were being detained for security reasons. The soldiers told us it was illegal to be there, and we said we would stay as long as the men were detained without charge. We said goodbye to all our new friends, and the bus drove away. We were in the middle of nowhere. The two men walked across the road to sit down. We sat down near them and leaned over to ask what was wrong. They said they had no idea. We waited. We watched the soldiers search an ambulance that had been waiting behind our bus with the emergency lights on for at least 20 minutes. The driver yelled to us that there was someone sick in the back. We all just shook our heads. The Israeli military justifies the systematic detention and holding up of Palestinian ambulances at checkpoints by citing stories of Palestinians using ambulances to transport weapons and, quote, wanted people in the past. As it turns out, most of these stories are fabricated. There's a footnote here to that sentence. In the entire history of the conflict, there has been one single documented incident of a Palestinian ambulance, possibly in italics, possibly being used to transport explosives, and even this is uncertain. Amnesty International wrote about the case, quote, "There are several suspicious circumstances about it. The ambulance passed through four checkpoints on the way to Jerusalem without being searched, which is abnormal, the fact that it was not searched, and then was delayed for more than an hour before being searched to allow TV cameras to arrive, which suggests that the army had, at the least, prior knowledge of something hidden there. Besides this alleged incident, the only documented ambulance abuses were abuses by Israel itself." This is taken from the passage Shielded from Security, Amnesty International, page 35, as cited in Finkelstein, his book Chutzpah, page 129. Now let's continue with the main text. As it turns out, most of these stories of Palestinians, of ambulances used to transport weapons and wanted people, were fabricated. But even if the accounts were true, one must remember that the soldiers are blocking ambulances traveling from one Palestinian town to another. How does controlling such movement enhance the security of the Israeli people as compared with the health risks to which it inevitably condemns innocent Palestinians? Aldo and I continued to wait. Occasionally, the soldiers would look over at us to see if we really intended to stay. We pretended we had all the time in the world. After another 15 minutes, the soldiers finally called up the two detained Palestinian men, gave them back their IDs, and told them to go. The two flashed us a wave and started their long walk home. Started their long walk home. Aldo and I walked the rest of the way to Samaria and had a pleasant picnic. On our way back, we came across the same two soldiers who were arguing with two new Palestinian men. One of the Palestinians was pointing angrily to a blocked-off parking lot full of taxis. The soldiers shooed the young men away, and when they came in our direction, we asked them what was wrong. They said they were taxi drivers and that the soldiers had taken away their keys along with those of eight other drivers 3 days ago. No one had been given any explanation as to why their keys were confiscated or any indication of when they would be returned, the keys, returned, if at all. They said this was not an uncommon occurrence and that they were going to walk to the police station. I remembered hearing about soldiers taking drivers' keys and either impounding their cars or making them do something humiliating like dance or bark like a dog to, quote, earn them back. I asked if the taxi drivers wanted Aldo and me to come for support, and they said the police station was 4 miles away. We decided against it. It was getting late. Instead, I gave them a card with phone numbers of helpful Palestinian and Israeli human rights organizations. They thanked us, hailed us a service taxi, and started their long walk over the hills into the night. I'm going to read to you one or two more footnotes to the texts I read to you from this journal entry. During the Second Intifada, more than 150 sick or injured Palestinians died at checkpoints. Again, during the Second Intifada, more than 150 sick or injured Palestinians died at checkpoints, Israeli checkpoints in the West Bank. That may include Gaza too, during the Second Intifada, after they were prevented from reaching a hospital. This is from the report, over 5,000 Palestinians killed by the Israeli army since 2000. Ma'an News Agency, February 21, 2007. One more note here. Dozens of Israeli veterans have come forward with stories of confiscating the keys of innocent drivers, either, quote, to teach the Palestinians a lesson, end quote, for leaving their homes or to assert their power. And then it gives, here are just two examples of many from www.breakingthesilence.org, etc. I am reading from Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine, a Jewish-American woman in the occupied territories, updated and revised 2014. New journal entry, Monday, December 1, 2003, Harvesting an Aerial Settlement. A few days ago, Ismail, the farmer I met a few weeks ago, who had been denied access to his olive trees because they are on land claimed, though not yet inhabited, by aerial settlers, finally obtained permission to finish harvesting before his crop is ruined by the rainy season. Ismail asked us to help his family pick olives today, both as protection from possible attacks from settlers or the army, and as labor desperately needed to make up for lost time. The soldier guarding Ariel was not happy to see us when my IWPS colleagues and I arrived. He told us flatly that we could not enter. He explained that we did not want to go to the settlement itself. We explained that we did not want to go to the settlement itself, only to pick olives with a farmer and his family on their land around the settlement. The soldier remained firm. We insisted that he call his superior, which he did. While we were waiting, my colleague, Karen, who speaks and reads a little Hebrew, read out loud the first words on a big sign in front of us. She sounded them out slowly and then asked, "What does Bruchim Habaim mean?" The soldier spoke under his breath. "It means welcome." Karen laughed. "I guess the sign was not made for us or Ismail." Having received orders to let us in, the soldier reluctantly stepped aside, and we entered Ariel, where we found Ismail, his sisters, wife, and mother harvesting their trees. It had rained the week before, so many olives had to be dug out from the mud on the ground. We picked for hours, fueled by flatbread with oil and spices. Around midday, we had visitors. An army jeep came speeding down the road, and two soldiers stuck their heads out the window to scream something in Hebrew, rather threateningly. We were caught off guard. I almost fell out of the tree in which I was picking olives. Ismail motioned to us to move to where we were visible, but to let him do the talking. When the soldiers saw me and other internationals, their tone softened. One soldier asked us how we were doing. The soldiers wanted Ismail to get off the land and go home. But after learning from Ismail where we were from, the soldiers themselves decided to leave. My colleagues and I offered to complain about the harassment, but Ismail said he preferred just to finish the work and avoid any more confrontations. He was not out to get apologies or compensation for his troubles. He just wanted to finish harvesting and go home. Apart from the brief clash, the atmosphere was pleasant. Ismail sang, and his wife and sister made fun of his terrible voice. Then the women sang, and I was reminded how many more tones traditional Arabic music uses compared to Western music. It's more melodic than harmonic, which is why at first it often sounds, quote, out of tune to Western ears. One woman stopped her singing to ask my age. I said I was 24. She told me she had a son my age and that she would like me to marry him. Mind you, this woman who's speaking here, Anna Balzer, is Jewish, and she's talking to non-Jewish Palestinian family members here. Continuing, I smiled and told her I had come to Palestine to work for peace, not to get married. Another woman asked my religion, and I answered that I was of Jewish origin. The mother who had asked me to marry her son looked over from her picking. The woman I had just answered looked surprised. The two began to talk excitedly. Ismail and his mother came over to join the conversation. I wished more than ever that I understood Arabic. When the conversation stopped, I felt a hand on my shoulder. I turned, and one woman cupped my face in her hands and, looking into my eyes, said something utterly incomprehensible to me, but no doubt very sweet. Another woman gave me a big hug, squeezing my hand as she walked away. Ismail's mother looked at me through the tree branches and nodded welcome. Finally, the mother of the 24-year-old came to me and kissed both my cheeks before asking, "So, will you marry my son?" We were interrupted by a tour bus that had stopped on the road 30 feet from where Ismail stood. What were people doing touring a settlement? The passengers, perhaps Jewish Americans or Israelis interested in moving to Ariel, sat mesmerized by the sight of Ismail and his family picking olives. They moved closer to the windows and then, one by one, took out their cameras to take pictures. Ismail and his family stood bewildered. Ismail waved his arms for the bus to drive away, but the passengers only took more pictures. I was nauseated. Ismail's wife looked at me hopelessly. Ismail's sister looked angry and humiliated and kept her head down as she continued to work. The whole scene filled me with anger. For one thing, photographing without permission is something of a taboo in the Islamic tradition. But it was watching the passengers gawk at Ismail and his family as if they were animals in a zoo that angered me most. I could only assume they were surprised to see Palestinians at work on their land instead of crouched in dark caves building bombs. The tour bus eventually left, and by the end of the day, the harvest was finished. Ismail had been turned away from his land for 2 months, but at last his trees were bare. The family rejoiced, put their olives and their 8-year-old son on the back of a donkey cart, and headed for home. My colleagues and I walked together with Ismail's wife and sisters through the aerial gate towards Kfar Haris. On our way, we passed an Israeli bus stop on the road where a young man was waiting with an M16 slung around his shoulder. He was a civilian, no more than a teenager. Suddenly, one of Ismail's sisters began to have a panic attack. She started breathing heavily and tears came to her eyes. We sat her down to rest and she tried to calm herself. When her breathing returned to normal, we walked as quickly as possible across aerial settler road back to the village. I don't know why the woman panicked. I didn't want to ask. She seemed embarrassed about her emotions, and yet the more I consider the situation, the more reasonable I find her reaction. There is nothing normal about 16-year-olds carrying semi-automatic weapons on their way to town. There is nothing sane about breezing through security if you have a yellow license plate, but getting the third degree if you have a donkey cart. It is not for those like Ismail's sister who get upset that I fear most. At least they still recognize the fundamental injustice of the situation. I'm most worried about those who have adapted themselves to the occupation so much that they aren't angry anymore, or even worse, those who simply accept life under the occupation because they have never known anything else. Friday, December 12. Movement planning and strategizing. I have been out of touch with my family and friends for the past few weeks. IWPS's computer network was down, and the man who usually fixes it was put in prison. Last weekend, I went to a meeting of ISM, International Solidarity Movement Coordinators, in Jayus, a small village of about 3,000 inhabitants in the Kalkilia district. The wall started in Jayus last fall, despite resistance by villagers and internationals who managed to prevent construction for 3 days before the army brought in more force. The wall now winds its way through the surrounding countryside, separating a house from the village and the village from its land and all 6 water wells. ISM is devoting several months to reevaluating the effectiveness of the organization and revising its mission statement. It was useful to meet the Palestinians and international volunteers who helped keep the movement alive and to hear them talk about the problems that can occur. For example, many foreign volunteers arrive in Palestine anxious to see some action and save some lives. ISM, and IWPS for that matter, is not about saving anyone. It is about supporting Palestinians in building their own movement against the occupation. It is arrogant to think that we Westerners can, quote, educate the Palestinians in their own resistance. The few weeks that most ISM volunteers stay for is not enough time to be properly trained and to begin to build trust within the community that could facilitate proactive collaboration in the future. Picture here of a nice meeting hall. Israeli activists, international volunteers, and locals from the Salfit region meet to discuss a peace camp against the impending wall in Deir Balut. Continuing with the book now. Last week I went to a Salfit community meeting of local residents, internationals, and Israelis interested in setting up an anti-wall peace camp in Deir Balut. A few dozen people attended the meeting, including the mayors of several villages and representatives from Palestinian political organizations who were all interested in working nonviolently. At the meeting, people shared ideas and feelings about working together against the wall. One Israeli woman shared her story, and here it is. "I am a Jewish Israeli. I am not here to give you an example of a good Jew. I am here to tell you how much my family hates me. I have two children almost 18 years old, and unlike most mothers who are proud to see their children grow into adults, I have a terrible feeling in the pit of my stomach because I know it is time for them to decide whether they will join the army or suffer the consequences of civil disobedience. I brought them here to the West Bank to show them the system that they could choose whether or not to be a part of. And they hate me for it. They hate me for showing them the underside of their privileged lives." She continues, "There was a missile that destroyed part of the wall recently, and although destroying the wall is a good use of a missile, we all know that the wall will only be built up again, even stronger, with more supporters. If we keep that in mind, whatever you decide to do, I will be there in support, with friends and with the conviction that nonviolence is the bravest and most effective strategy." Now, Anna here writes, "Munira's husband, Hani, whose family has been caged in by the wall in Masa, was also present at the meeting, and he spoke with conviction, saying this, 'I am not here because the wall damaged my house and my family. I am not here because I am Palestinian. I am here because I am a human being who wants the best for humanity. I understand that nobody can stop the wall, but at the very least, let people say in the future that it did not pass without resistance. We must demonstrate to show how wrong this is, and to support the people whose lives continue to be ruined by the wall. When the land around my house was being destroyed, there were so many people who called, who heard my story, and who stood in solidarity with me. The media was there too, and it all made a difference to me, even if it did not stop the wall.'" End of statement. It was Hani's first sentences that struck me the most. "When I tell people in the United States that I'm working in the West Bank, they always ask the same question, 'Which side are you on, the Palestinian or the Israeli?' I never know what to answer. The question sounds so absurd to me. This is not a struggle between Palestinians and Israelis. It's a struggle for freedom and basic human rights. I would be doing the same work if the roles were reversed. What does it even mean to be on the, quote, Israeli side? It's not easy to find two Israelis who agree about the situation, let alone unanimity in the whole country. There are Israelis all over the political spectrum, and to say that Israelis support the occupation is to ignore the considerable heterogeneity of Israeli opinion." While Palestinians agree that they want the occupation to end, they are less unified regarding what they would like to happen after that. A large number of Palestinians, for example, would rather see a single secular state for both Jews and Palestinians than a country called Palestine for Palestinians only. So which side am I on? I am on the side of human dignity and self-determination. I am on the side of those who seek equal rights for all, regardless of religion, nationality, or ethnicity. This is the struggle of everyone sharing those ideals, even if today the victims are Palestinian. Tomorrow they could be you. This is your struggle too. And dear listeners, it is now 2 minutes past 12 noon. You are listening to the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren Tawil, on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming live and free at www.freakradio.org. Freakradio.org. A reminder, these recorded programs of my readings and of the contents of my Monday program, Mideast Migraines, every Monday at 3 p.m. The archives of the shows are available at radioforall.net, radioforall.net, and Santa Cruz Media Center, Indy Bay, Indy Bay, I-N-D-Y-B-A-Y. You may write to me via this program's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's MideastMadness at G as in gigantic, M as in minuscule, X as in whatever, xylophone, Xerxes, Xander, gmx.com, MideastMadness@gmx.com. We will have another musical break, during which I'll take your phone calls. Here are the two telephone numbers. The lines are open. The area code for both lines is 831. That's here in Santa Cruz County on the central coast of California. Area 831. Line 1 is 427-3772. 427-3772. Line 2 is 469-3119. Line 2, 469-3119. The lines are open.
اسمع المجلس من نعينا فندي كلكنت وهات معدود
Thank you. وانا
Once again, hearing from the Rounder Records album, the music of Arab Americans, recorded, obviously, in the United States. A retrospective, or in North America anyway, the music of Arab Americans, a retrospective collection, 1997. You heard track 9. It's called Flute Imitation. Interestingly, but that, of course, was a fiddle of sorts. It may have another Arabic name. Flute Imitation. Yeah. Naeem Karakhan, violin, oud, and drum. The instruments involved. The announcement, Isma al-Mijwiz min Naeem Effendi Karaband. Listen to the Mijwiz from Mr. Naeem Karaband. Indicates that this is not the imitation of a flute, as is written in the record label, but rather of the single reed, double piped, quote, clarinets of Levantine folk music, the Mijwiz. Recorded in the early 1920s, Karaband's performance reflects the affinity of Arab musicians and audiences for the reedy nasal timbre of this folk instrument. His imitation of the Mijwiz is accomplished by a technique heard widely throughout the Levant and in Turkey, Greece, and perhaps even other areas in the Balkans. The Balkans are in southeasternmost Europe, adjacent to Turkey. The top two strings of the violin pardon me. The top two strings of the violin top two strings of the violin are tuned in near unison, as are the two bottom strings, an octave below. Following a brief non-metric prelude, Karaband's playing is continuous and measured and replicates the effects of circular breathing and the constant reference to the tonic or drone more typical of Mijwiz playing. The enthusiastic remarks of Karakhan's compatriots present at the recording session add to the spirit of this performance. Although there are hardly any musicians who play the Mijwiz today, the affection for the sound of the instrument has hardly waned among contemporary audiences. Today, however, the Mijwiz, or the double reed folk oboe, mizmar or zamir, are replicated on the synthesizer during long medleys of folk songs that accompany the daka. A robust line dance from the Levant that is a prerequisite component of Arab American celebrations. Let's get back to the reading. Saturday editions of Mideast Migraines on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. We are reading from Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine, a Jewish-American woman in the occupied territories, updated and revised just last year. Saturday, December 13, 2003, Uprooting the History and Future of Palestine. When we look out of our window in Haris, we see parallel to the settler road, a flattened dirt road that grows with time as more of our neighbors' olive trees are cut down. The army claims to be expanding the settler road. Other officials claim that they are digging to build a new water system. But there is a sinking feeling of disbelief in all of us, an understanding that this is probably the beginning of the wall in our village. One extremely frustrating aspect of the wall is that it's rarely clear where and when it's coming. The Israeli government and military have been reluctant to publish official maps of the planted route, so the related land confiscation often comes as a surprise. Some farmers have never even heard of the wall that will soon separate them from their land or their communities. Occasionally, the Army issues demolition orders for houses, but more often the bulldozers show up unannounced and begin cutting down trees. This way, Palestinians cannot organize ahead of time or ensure that media are present to document the events as they occur. Sometimes the land raising goes on for days, sometimes for weeks. Then suddenly it stops and continues in another village far away. This strategy keeps the Palestinians guessing. Meanwhile, the wall is built in small pieces here and there that looks harmless enough until they are connected. If this wall were truly a legitimate construction, what would be the point of keeping it such a secret? Why doesn't the government publish the plan map of Israeli and international? Why doesn't the government publish the plan map in Israeli and international newspapers for all to see? Up until now, the only maps widely available are pieced together by peace organizations. A week ago, villagers in neighboring Kfir Haris called us frantically because bulldozers had appeared out of the blue and were uprooting their trees. By the time we arrived, the owners were beside themselves. They kept screaming, "Hamil!" as the ancient trees were ripped from the ground by the monstrous machines. Hamil is a word that can be used to describe trees during the time they bear fruit. It means pregnant. Hamil. Not every olive tree can be Hamil. It takes over 20 years for olive trees to begin to bear fruit. Until then, the owner must tend to the young tree to assist it in the process of aging. Season after season, the farmer returns to the tree, nursing its wounds from storms, making sure it receives just the right amount of sun, trimming branches that block the light and nutrients that will help it mature. It is not an exaggeration to personify trees with the word Hamil. To many families who have been with their trees for hundreds of years, generation after generation, the fruit bearers are an integral part of the family. I felt sick watching the trees rip from the earth. Some of the trees looked thousands of years old. Their roots were so strong. By the time the wall is completed, more than 2 million trees will have been uprooted since 2001. Some of them may have stood during the time of the Romans and Jesus. They are irreplaceable. Stealing them is a rape of the land and the destruction of both the history and the future of the Palestinian people. I took pictures and had a couple of uncomfortable conversations with the construction workers who insisted they were uprooting trees for peace. They left behind what felt like a mass grave with trampled olives and oil instead of blood. After they left, the family stood in shocked silence, except a few young boys sifting through the broken pieces of their family's livelihood, picking out branches to take home for firewood. Some electric lines and water pipes had also been destroyed by the work, so the village had lost electricity and water for 3 days. I recently returned to Kfir Haris demolished groves to take more photographs. Beyond the recently leveled road visible from Haris is an enormous canyon. It's unlikely that the road will extend into it, as soldiers claim, because of its depth. I walked through the canyon past the bulldozers and cranes and then climbed up a side of rubble near the main road. Hidden beyond the remaining trees was another piece of equipment used for demolition, a smaller one. I approached and found the machine clearing out a new ditch alongside the road. This one even deeper than the canyon. I immediately thought of the wall. The driver of the bulldozers did not yet see me, and I managed to take a few pictures before I was discovered. Within seconds, two security guards appeared at my side, telling me to leave immediately. I was standing on a public street and quite sure I was doing nothing illegal, so I remained. One angry guard tried to push me with his hand, but I shook off his touch violently and gave him a look of warning, surprising even myself. The other guard told him not to touch me. He probably knew that my complaints about army abuse could reach further than those of a Palestinian. When I got tired of the guard screaming inches from my face, I began to walk away. The guards got into their truck and drove up to me. One stuck his head out of the window and made kissing noises. I shivered with disgust, and they drove off. Monday, December 15, 2003. Flying checkpoints and a demonstration in Arham. On Saturday, we went to an anti-wall demonstration sponsored by Ta'ayush, a grassroots movement of Palestinian and Jewish citizens of Israel. The demonstration took place in Aram, a town between Jerusalem and Ramallah, normally 90 minutes from Haris, but this time it took us that long just to get out of the Salfit region. I got my first taste of flying checkpoints, which are like regular checkpoints, but mobile, meaning they can pop up unannounced anywhere at any time. For the first hour, our bus was stopped nearly every mile by soldiers standing in the middle of the road, blocking traffic and searching Palestinians. As usual, yellow-plated Israeli cars were allowed to pass unobstructed. At the first flying checkpoint, we waited for 20 minutes until a soldier emptied us out of a bus and checked our IDs before letting us continue. 2 minutes later, soldiers stopped our bus again, insisting that the repeated checking was a security measure due to a threat of terrorism in the area. I could think of several nearby terrorist attacks by non-Palestinians. And parenthetically, our weekend plans to pick olives in Deir Istia had in fact been canceled after an unarmed 19-year-old village boy was shot twice in the hand and near his rectum by the army. Deir Istia was put under curfew to prevent retaliation. Of course, curfew also prevented the victim's parents from visiting him in the hospital. And other villagers, like the farmers we were to pick with, from going to work or school. I refrain from pointing out the irony of the illegal occupation forces punishing Palestinians for, quote, terror. We were already late. After getting through the second flying checkpoint, we drove all of 4 minutes before being stopped again at Zatara Permanent Checkpoint, where there was another line of vehicles waiting. The line was long and unlikely to move for at least 30 minutes, so my colleague and I got out to take pictures, agreeing to meet our bus when it passed the corner ahead. There are several Palestinian ambulances waiting as usual. The ambulances were told to move to the side of the road so Israeli cars could pass. Jeez. I just have to break in here. I'll say it again. The ambulances, which usually, what we're used to in this country, have blaring, blinking lights and ear-piercing sirens to tell everybody else to get out of the way. In this situation, the Palestinian ambulances were told to move to the side of the road so Israeli cars could pass. Several Israeli cars were blocked for a few minutes by the commotion, and they began honking impatiently. Apparently, they had places to be. Half an hour after our bus finally made it through Zatara, we arrived at the demonstration at last to find about 2,000 protesters cheering and waving flags in Hebrew, Arabic, and English. The sun was shining, the mood friendly, and the atmosphere international. There were hundreds of Israeli activists who had come to show their support. Now, this would be support for Palestinians, of course. The crowd had built a 10-foot fake wall that people were spray-painting with peace slogans as television crews filmed. Within minutes, drums began to sound and the crowd stirred with excitement. A group of protesters charged the wall, ripping it apart, styrofoam flying everywhere. The crowd was thrilled. Before I knew it, a cheer erupted from my throat. I was overcome with emotion as I imagined the day when Palestinians and Israelis will tear down the real wall together, freeing themselves from the mutually destructive system of separation. The mutually destructive system of separation. Tuesday, December 16, 2003. On Saturday night, a friend from Mashab village called to say that for several weeks, many farmers there have not been allowed through the wall to reach their land. Although the Israeli government claims that permits and gates allow Palestinian farmers to access their land across the wall, the reality is that permits can be impossible to obtain, and soldiers are rarely on hand to open the gates even when farmers have the permits. A colleague and I agreed to accompany the farmers in the hope that we would have more luck in reasoning with the soldiers. The next morning we walked from Mashab village to the gate with three farmers, their donkeys, one child, and four Israeli activists who had come from Tel Aviv to help. The farmers said the army passed by about once an hour on the security road on the other side, but that they rarely stopped when there were only two Palestinians waiting. We began to wait. We waited an hour with no sign of the army. Two farmers sat down on the ground beside the road. Another farmer went to fetch us food from the village. One farmer's small child walked up to the gate and started to shake it, trying to break through. He could see his family's land on the other side. After a while, he sat down, playing a game of putting small stones through the holes in the fence. In rural parts of Palestine, the wall is composed of wire fence instead of the concrete that is used in urban areas. Unlike a typical fence, the wall is armed with heavy-duty electric sensory wire, thermal imaging, video cameras, sniper towers, and razor wire. It's not the kind of fence you'd have in your backyard. It's the kind of, quote, fence that surrounds U.S. prisons. The fence sections of the wall are also more destructive to the landscape, since almost all trees and crops within at least 100 feet have to be cleared to make room for an army road, a 6-foot trench, and another fence on each side. Three fences, two trenches, and two roads in all. Some Palestinians say they prefer the concrete sections of the wall, where they can usually at least access the land left on their side of it. We tapped the electric wire a few times, hoping it would provoke the army to come investigate. Sure enough, Jeep pulled up and three soldiers hopped out. The soldier in charge explained that something had happened and all the gates had to be closed. He apologized on behalf of the army, saying things were not run the way he would like. Off the record, he said to an Israeli activist with us, I'm getting out of the army in a few months and I'll come join you on the other side. The activist was unimpressed. I'll believe it when I see it, he explained to me later. He's one of many Israeli soldiers who tell themselves they are against the occupation, but the occupation would not function without them. We called the District Coordination Office, DCO, a supposed facilitator for movement in the occupied territories, and were told that the gates would open an hour later at noon. We spent the next 5 hours waiting in vain before giving up and heading home. We decided to return at 8 a.m. the next morning when the DCO had assured us again that the gate would be open. A colleague and I arrived at the gate with the farmers around sunrise and began to wait. The army did not come. At one point, a truck passed slowly along the road spraying pesticides through the fence, and we ran to avoid being sprayed. One farmer said it was plant poison to keep grass from growing near the wall. At last, an army jeep drove down the road. We waved empathically, but it passed without stopping. I wanted to scream. The farmers were more patient. One of them was a cheery man with short legs that bounced on his donkey when he rode it. The other farmer was older, and the entire left half of his body was paralyzed. He walked slowly with a cane, taking frequent breaks but never complaining, even after walking and standing for hours with no results. Sometimes when he found his balance, he would set his cane aside and take out two sheets of paper with his functioning hand. One was a land deed that he said went back to Ottoman times, proving that the land belonged to his family. The other was an Israeli permit allowing him access to his land from mid-November to mid-February. He would look through the papers over and over again, reading through them to himself, as if trying to understand what he'd done wrong. At 9 o'clock, one jeep finally stopped. Two indifferent-looking soldiers leaned their heads out, listened to our story, and then drove away. They said they had no orders to open the gate and, quote, didn't feel like calling DCO to check. We continued to wait. 20 minutes later, another jeep stopped, and four soldiers hopped out. It's amazing how diverse the soldiers can be. One soldier wearing reflecting sunglasses and a smirk yelled, Sabah al-Khair, good morning in Arabic, in a sarcastic tone. Another soldier was older and quieter. The Palestinians picked him out and brought their case to him. Look, these women came here from France and America to help us, one farmer said, pointing to us. Won't you help us? The soldier was too distracted to answer. His partners were laughing at something funny one of them had said. One of the soldiers eventually spoke up. Look, he said, we were only doing this for security. There are terrorists, and that's why everything is closed. End quote. I asked him if he thought the two unarmed old men were a threat, pointing out that one of the men was half paralyzed. Quote, you never know. I asked the soldier if he thought it was right to treat everyone as a terrorist because you never know. I pointed to his friend. What about him? No, he's not a terrorist. So you only suspect certain people of being terrorists. Don't you think that's a little prejudiced? He paused. What are we supposed to do? We have orders not to open the gate. There have been, quote, there have been some heroic people in history who were strong enough to disobey unjust orders. Alternatively, you could call the DCO that told us the gate would be open. The soldier disappeared for 10 minutes and returned. He told the other soldiers to take away the razor wire, and he opened the gate to let us through. I asked him how we would get back into the village after we were finished. He asked what time we preferred, and the farmer said noon. He agreed, and we began walking to the land. It had rained hard the night before, so the farmers could not pick or plow, but they seemed content just to be on their land. After a while, the cheery farmer suggested we have a picnic and called to ask his family to bring breakfast and supplies. We watched him approach. We watched him approach the gate and catch bread, soda, and hummus as his son threw them over one by one. He rode back to us on his donkey, whistling an old song that bounced as he did. We feasted for an hour or so before going back to the gate to wait to be let back into the village. It's 12:34 in the afternoon this Saturday, March 7th. You're listening to the Mideast Migraine Show. Saturday's reading of the book Witness in Palestine, A Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories by Anna Balzer. Friday, December 19. Deir Balut Peace Camp against the wall. For the past few weeks, Palestinians from the Salfit region, Israeli activists, and volunteers from IWPS and ISM have been meeting regularly to organize a peace camp against the wall in a half-built school at the edge of Deir Balut, a small Palestinian village that has since grown very close to my heart. The school lies on the expected path of the wall, so it is slated for demolition, something that we hope the presence of Israeli and international activists can help prevent, or at least publicize. The purpose of the camp is to bring activists together to provide a space for learning and strategizing resistance to the wall, and to publicize the wall's destructive impact on Palestinian rural communities. Over the course of 2 weeks, the camp will host activities including nonviolence workshops, television interviews, tree planting, and nonviolent demonstrations. The idea for a camp was inspired by last summer's peace camp in Mas'ha, where thousands of Palestinians, Israelis, and international volunteers camped out together in solidarity on the land threatened by the wall. The camp was started by Palestinian farmers and remained for over 4 months until soldiers came and arrested over 70 nonviolent activists. The wall proceeded to take 95% of the village's land. Although Mas'ha Peace Camp didn't stop the wall, it did make international headlines and expose the nature of the wall as an obstacle to peace. Deir Balut Peace Camp Against the Wall began yesterday. We marched from town hall to the abandoned school on the outskirts of the village, overlooking some of the thousands of olive trees that the village stands to lose. We marched with banners, and young boys climbed onto the roof to display welcome signs and wave to newcomers. Within a few hours, we had started settling in. The village electricians connected cables all the way from the village and set up lights in both the men's and women's rooms. Others stacked bricks in the glassless windows to keep out wind and rain. I lay down sleeping bags and hung up signs calling on Israel to clear out of Palestine and men to keep out of the women's sleeping room. At night, we hovered around the fire, sipping fresh sage tea and talking. Some internationals played guitar and sang while three Israelis and I settled down to a game of poker. I met Gavriel, a young Israeli activist whose family moved to Israel from South Africa many years ago. "From one apartheid to another," he said, and I looked up from my cards, hoping he would tell me more. Quote, "My uncle is a settler near Bethlehem. My cousin just founded a new outpost near Hebron. She's in Kahane Chai, They believe God promised them this land, just like the Afrikaner people used to say about South Africa. They feel no guilt as they literally take land from under farmers' feet. They think I'm evil for what I'm doing. They say I'm going against my country, against my people, just like people used to say in South Africa. It's the same, really. So how did you turn out so great? I asked, smiling. That's the funny thing, he said, smiling back. My family raised me with good values. They just use a double standard when it comes to Israel. That made sense to me. I can't relate when people say some settlers are just, quote, evil. Most people have some sense of morality and ethics. They just become blind at times from brainwashing. People like Gavriel have sacrificed a great deal. Gavriel spent 2 months in prison for refusing to join the military. Other conscientious objectors risk serving up to 3 years, but it doesn't end there. Gavriel continued, "In Israel, being a soldier is the pride of your family. Many young Israelis are afraid their families would hate or even disown them if they refused. They say that if you're not, or weren't, a soldier, then you're not a man. It's hard to choose to be an outcast." Lots of my friends who are soldiers agree with me, but say they can't resist the pressure of this militarized society. We are encouraged from day one to join the army and fight for our country. In school, we spend 1 year on world history and 2 years on the Nazi Holocaust. After that kind of education, we all walk away thinking just two things. We're really scared, and we have to defend ourselves at all costs, because we have nowhere else to go. That's a dangerous attitude, especially when you're handing a gun to every high school graduate. He continues, "We learned that this land is ours. They call it, quote, a land without a people for a people without a land." Never mind the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians kicked out in 1948, or the 450 villages that were destroyed. Tel Aviv University, where I study, used to be an Arab village. Does anyone know that? No. Jewish terrorists of the past are heroes. And people who refuse to fight for more land? We're traitors. It's all your classic signs of a fascist government. The economic instability, the security hysteria, the culture of fear. End of statement. I couldn't help but consider Gavriel's observation in relation to my own country. Many American liberals are progressive on all subjects except Israel-Palestine. We, too, are taught from grade school about the Nazi Holocaust. It is at the forefront of our minds when we imagine any sort of injustice in the world. That's why, until recently, I too was ashamed to criticize Israel. Jews are supposed to be the victims. How can they be the oppressors too? Many people refuse to face the paradox. For them, Israel can do no wrong, period. Gavriel continued. Very long passage here from Gavriel. The worst part of all is that people really don't know what's actually going on. One of my friends lives 10 minutes away from the Qalqilya ghetto, and he couldn't tell you a thing about what life is like here. People are so removed. You feel it as you drive back into Israel, into the lights and the billboards and the traffic. You forget. And your only reminders are headlines of violent Arabs. Headlines that never mention how many fewer civilians are killed by Palestinians than by the Israeli military. Headlines that make you want to be more and more removed and, quote, safe. When I tell my friends who join the army what I think of what they're doing, they start complaining about the unpleasant reality of their own lives. I can sympathize. I say, yeah, life as a soldier sucks. But have some perspective. Life 10 minutes away from here is a living hell. Compared to that, you are living in a paradise. That hell is what plagues your life, too. And you have the power to change it. We all do if we work together. but nobody wants to be the one to do it. Students here aren't liberal like in other countries. They think, hey, after 3 years in the Army, I have served my country. I don't have to feel any responsibility anymore. Some liberal Israelis even join the Army thinking that as a humane soldier, they will be replacing someone who could have been even worse. There are so many excuses. The fact is, lining the Green Line with soldiers would bring Israel more security than the current policies do. But my family and people like them would never accept that. They want more than security. They want land. I know from experience how hard it is to resist the system, but I still expect people to do it, and I don't excuse them if they don't. It's wrong. It's immoral. It's South Africa all over again, and anyone who thinks they have done no harm despite their participation in the system is fooling themselves. One of my soldier friends told me a story recently. He said he and his team were occupying a flat in Ramallah. They knew they would need the building to have ideal shooting visibility in the neighborhood. So they charged into the house and locked the family downstairs below their apartment with their hands tied behind their backs. All this in the middle of the night. Picture it. Grandma's fainting. Grandpa's shaking. Daddy's already in the slammer with almost all the other under 40-year-old men in the neighborhood. Children are clinging to their tied-up mothers as they cry. What will become of those children? What do we expect that child to become? A peace activist? I tell my friends in the Army, expect the bullet. Expect the rock. You are in someone else's land. If someone were on your land, you would do the same thing? And deep down, they know that I'm right. End of statement. Gavriel's mention of the Qalqilya ghetto reminded me of my last trip north along Israel's Highway 6, west of the Green Line. I was stunned by the difference between the way the wall looks from the Palestinian city of Qalqilya and the way it looked from the Israeli highway. On the Israeli side, with the grass and flower beds built up almost to the top, so it didn't even look like a wall. I realized that although Israelis are generally much better informed about the occupation than most Americans, many of them may not necessarily know what the wall looks like. They may see the top of it as they drive to work every morning, but do they really know what the wall is about? Where it's being built, and how it's affecting average Palestinians. Disguising the Israeli side of the wall prevents the reality of what the Israeli government and army are doing from reaching the average Israeli citizen. That's why activists like Gavriel are so important. They bring the realities across the Green Line and provide an alternative youth culture to the militarism that Gavriel described. I stayed up the first night of Deir Balut Peace Camp with activists like Gavriel, discussing our hopes of what the camp can accomplish. 2 weeks of like-minded Palestinians, Israelis, and internationals, coexisting in the same space with respect and companionship in the spirit of solidarity is, at the very least, a step in the right direction. Incidentally, several minutes ago, I read in that last journal entry, I read from the paragraph, "My uncle is a settler near Bethlehem. My cousin just founded a new outpost near Hebron. She's in Kahane Chai. They believe God promised them this land, just like the Afrikaner people used to say about South Africa." The footnote there makes reference to Kahane Chai is a far-right Israeli political party advocating the forcible expulsion of Palestinians from Israel and the occupied territories. It is on both Israel's and the United States State Department's list of terrorist organizations. Kahane Chai. I believe the word Kahane refers to the late Mayor Kahane, who probably founded the party. He outwardly advocated forcible expulsions of Palestinians, did noteworthy things like taking and tearing up deeds, grabbing them from the hands of Arab landowners as though they never existed. Kahane was assassinated some 20-odd years ago by an Egyptian in Manhattan, as I recall. Let's see. Tide. Okay. It's 12:49. I have some 10, 11 minutes to remaining in the program. Entry, Sunday, December 21. That's December 21. Birth and death at Deir Balut checkpoint. I woke up early on the second morning of the peace camp to observe Deir Balut checkpoint. Deir Balut has the misfortune of having both a checkpoint and roadblocks obstructing movement into and out of the village. The main road is obstructed by four large concrete blocks. To reach the checkpoint on the other side of the blocks, travelers must take a 2-mile unpaved detour through the countryside or walk on the main road past the blocks and wait for public transportation. I walked across the roadblocks to find about 30 cars waiting after they had taken the long way around. It was almost 8 in the morning. The checkpoint was supposed to have opened at 7, but the soldiers were late for work. So were almost 100 Palestinians who had to wait for them. Deir Balut checkpoint closes every evening at 7. Anyone who arrives any later is simply out of luck. Less than 24 hours after I left the checkpoint at 2 a.m., the following morning, a local woman named Hessa, who was 7 months pregnant with twins, began having contractions. Her husband drove her quickly to the checkpoint, which they needed to cross to reach the nearest hospital in Ramallah. When they reached the checkpoint, the soldiers sleeping above it came down to meet the frantic couple. They were very polite and said, "The rule is very clear. Palestinians are not allowed through until 7 in the morning. Please come back at 7. Hessa clearly couldn't wait 6 hours to have her babies, so they argued a bit more. Again, the soldiers were very polite, even apologetic. They just kept saying the same thing over and over. "Look, we didn't make the rules, and we don't even agree with them. We're just following orders." Hessa's husband called an ambulance to come from Ramallah, about 25 miles away, to the other side of the checkpoint so that his wife could simply walk through on foot and be shuttled back to Ramallah. For the next hour, Hessa waited in pain with her worried family in the winter night. Hessa's pain increased dramatically, waiting in the cold, and soon she was ready to give birth. When the ambulance finally arrived, the soldiers shook their heads again, apologetically. "Look, it doesn't matter if you're crossing by foot or by car. You're still a Palestinian." These are the soldiers talking. "You're still a Palestinian. It's still the middle of the night. You still can't cross." End quote. At that point, Hess's husband exploded with anger, telling the soldiers they could punish him however they wanted, but that his wife must be let through. The soldiers called their superiors, who arrived 20 minutes later. By this time, the family had been waiting more than 2 hours in the cold. The army agreed to let Hessa through, but not her husband. Before letting her onto the stretcher, they examined her stomach to make sure it wasn't a bomb. Hessa gave birth to the twins in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, but because they were premature, as twins often are, the babies required immediate hospitalization. One baby died before arriving at the hospital. The second baby died the next day. Footnote, stories like Hessa's are not uncommon. In its, quote, Operation Defensive Shield, Soldiers' Testimonies, Palestinian Testimonies, 2002 report, Betzalem tells a similar story. Here's that story. This is all the footnotes to what I just read to you. Quote, on Friday, April 5, 2002, Tahani Ali Assad Fatu, a pharmacist from El Emsakan Ash Shaabia in the Nablus district, began having labor pains. Her husband, Dr. Ghassan Ali Nashat Shahar, called an ambulance to take his 7 months pregnant wife to the hospital. Due to the curfew imposed on the area, the ambulance could not reach the house, and Dr. Shahar had to deliver the baby with the help of his neighbor, Dr. Shulfay. The delivery went smoothly. During the delivery, the ambulance crew tried to reach the couple's house, as the newborn would have to be placed in an incubator. All attempts failed. Some 30 minutes after the birth, the baby's health began to deteriorate. Dr. Shahar managed to resuscitate his son twice. On the third attempt, the baby died. Tahani Fatu had become pregnant after 4 years of fertility treatments. The hospital is only 2 kilometers, less than a mile and a half, away from the couple's home, end quote. During the first 4 years of the Second Intifada, 13 newborn infants died at checkpoints. This from Gideon Levy, killing children is no longer a big deal, from Haaretz, October 17, 2004. When this book went to press in 2007, at least 68 Palestinian women had given birth at checkpoints since 2001, according to PASSIA, P-A-S-S-I-A, 2007. One last paragraph to complete this journal entry. If Heza had known it would take so long to pass through the checkpoint, she could have taken a different road to Ramallah, one that is much longer and bumpier, but has no checkpoint. There is only a roadblock where the ambulance could have met her. Anyone who wants to get from Deir Balut to Ramallah without passing through a checkpoint can do so, and the army knows that. Just like they know, Deir Balut's roadblock simply requires Palestinians to take an uncomfortable detour in their cars, meaning more money for gas, more wear and tear on their vehicles, and more stress overall. The primary consequence of checkpoints and roadblocks is not increased security for Israel, but strain on daily life, accelerating the breakdown of Palestinian society. I wish everyone, especially the soldiers, most of whom are convinced they are following orders designed to protect their families and communities, could see that. We are at the end of today's readings from Anna Baltzer's Witness in Palestine, a Jewish-American woman in the occupied territories. In the 3 or 4 minutes left in this program, I want to remind everyone once again to please remind everyone you know about this program, the book reading Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines at 11 a.m. Pacific Time. And we do stream around the world at freakradio.org in addition to broadcasting on the FM dial at 101.3. Tell everyone about this program. You may acquire a copy of the book, this book, Witness in Palestine. Go to paradigmpublishers.com for details. Don't forget that the recordings of these programs are archived at radioforall.net. That's radio, the number for all.net. Santa Cruz, Indy Bay. You may send a message to this program's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. In particular, I would very much appreciate hearing you, dear listener, your suggestions for the direction that you think I should be going in airing the Saturday edition at 11 in the morning and the Monday edition at 3 p.m. in the afternoon. If you think there is something more, something other that I could be doing, to facilitate the constructive, positive effect of this program, I want to hear that from you. It is vitally important, I feel, for some interaction between you, the listener, and myself. This program is produced and hosted entirely by myself. By the way, I am hoping to interview a gentleman. I'm not sure what part of the world he is in right now. He's American-born. But he is Jewish, and I expect to interview him by Skype, remote interview, on the Monday program, next Monday, March 9th, at 3 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. We are flipping over to Daylight Savings Time, starting at 2 a.m. tomorrow, 2 hours after midnight. We here in California go, I believe the entire state goes to daylight savings, beginning tomorrow, very early tomorrow, Sunday, March 8th. I thank you for joining me. Peace be upon you, regardless of your faith or faithlessness. You may interpret that any way you wish. And until I will continue the readings of Anna Balcher's Witness in Palestine next Saturday, 11 o'clock. Until then, thank you again for joining me. Ta-ta.